to a special 3NR podcast here at the NDCA Championships at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. I am here with Roy Lefkowitz and two special guests, Jonathan Paul, who is the Director of Debate at Georgetown University and the host of the NDCA Championships, and a former NDT champion while at Northwestern University, and Will Repko, the debate coach at Michigan State University, who has coached three NDT champions in the last 7 years, including this year's National Debate Tournament champions, Carly Wunderlich and Eric Lanning. We're going to talk about two things today. First, we're going to talk about tournament preparation. How do you prepare for your most important tournament? And for Michigan State or Georgetown, that's the NDT. For you, it might be the Tournament of Champions. It might be the NDCA tournament. It might be NFL Nationals or CFL Nationals, or it might just be your state tournament or your local NFL district tournament. What techniques or what strategies do these coaches use to approach the NDT, and kind of what advice can they give for you as you prepare for your big tournament of the year? And then second, we're going to talk about what high school debaters should think about or how they should approach debating in college, especially those debaters who are not the best national circuit debaters, those debaters who either have less national exposure or who are less successful than maybe they would like to be in high school, and who are worried that that lack of success will prevent them from being recruited by a college and having a successful college career. So the first thing we're going to talk about is tournament preparation. And Will, we'll start with just kind of a broad question. When do you start preparing for your big tournament of the year, which is the NDT? Is it something you immediately consider at the start of the season? Is it something that you kind of begin your preseason preparation with the NDT in mind, or do you think more about it as we get later in the season? Kind of what is your overall philosophy about preparation for the NDT?
Well, I think any program, sports program, debate program, has sort of long-term decisions that they make and sort of short-term decisions that they make. And so at some level, you could say that when we decide who we're going to hire, when we decide who we're considering recruiting, you're thinking about the NDT years in advance. But the truth of the matter is that I think the biggest adjustment I made as a young coach was to take the advice of some, I thought, really good directors that were at other programs who encouraged me to start preparing for the NDT earlier than I had been preparing for it. And so I would say for us, we have a goal of kind of trying to have any sort of new affirmatives or sort of prominent new negative arguments done in the tail end of January, and to begin to practice those. Different kids kind of operate differently. The students that I worked with this year kind of liked to practice their things and get better at them. Some students, you know, hate that, so you got to kind of adjust on the fly. But I think you're behind the curveball if you're not preparing a little bit early for those events.
Jonathan, you debated for Scott Dethridge, who was probably the winningest coach in NDT history. As a debater at Northwestern, did that program kind of operate in the same way, sort of begin the season with the NDT in mind, or is it something that sort of became more of a focal point later in the season?
Philosophically, yes. Duck always said at our first meeting that we started preparation for the NDT that day. And at Northwestern, one thing when he was there that just kind of was always occurring was we would have these long, drawn-out strategy meetings in August, right after the topic came out. And we want to cut cards and write arguments, but Duck refused to let us leave these meetings for just hours on end, brainstorming away. And it was funny because we, in the moment, you think this has no relevance whatsoever. And it's funny how many times we'd go back to those notes and find new app ideas or counterplan strategies that we hadn't invested in. All of our new affirmatives we read at the NDT in 2002 were ideas that we had brainstormed at the Rogers house in August. It doesn't always work out that way, of course, but he definitely has the NDT always in mind.
Roy, as you debated at Emory, another extremely successful program. Is the Emory philosophy kind of the same in that regard?
Well, I think that there's definitely a moment, you know, as the second semester starts, and it kind of segues to what I was going to ask Will about, was that you find that in January after the coast, that's when you kind of do that evaluating the way the topic goes. Because, you know, for the TOC for us now, it's after Harvard, we kind of go back to the drawing board, look at everything and say we've got, you know, 3 months between Harvard and the TOC to make a big list of assignments. Do you find that, you know, is it after the coast or, you know, when is it that you sort of are like, you know, do you ever look at the topic and say, okay, you know, this is how the topic has moved forward or gone forward and this is how we're going to kind of look at it for the NDT in the last couple tournaments?
Well, I don't mean to give a vague answer, but I think it does depend a little bit on the topic. And let me give a kind of concrete example on that. You know, your senior year in college, the topic was a Chinese pressure topic. And we did a ton of work in August and early September and reached the conclusion that there were no good affirmatives on the entire topic and that the blueprint that we needed to pursue on that topic was to run sort of as many affirmatives as possible. I'm sure that that was irritating.
A little bit.
and our rationale for that wasn't necessarily to win as many debates as we could during the regular season. It was to kind of teach the students how to break new affirmatives on that particular topic. This year, you know, in particular, Greta Stahl, who I work with, and Dave Strauss, they did a lot of work at the start of the season to kind of figure out, was there that one good, durable affirmative that had legs? And, you know, basically the two of them got into a fight as to whether or not CTBT or the no first use affirmative on this nuclear weapons topic was sort of that genre of affirmative, and they ultimately agreed that no first use was sort of the way to go. So that's sort of a long-winded way of saying that I kind of think that you need to make, at the start of the season, kind of big decisions about what your approach to the whole resolution is going to be. So there isn't kind of a fixed point in time when, after the Harvard tournament in high school or after the coast in college, the topic kind of needs to be reevaluated. I kind of think that you make a decision at the start of the year what your vision is going to be for the affirmative. And then a lot of the other stuff kind of comes on the fly. Like if you realize, ooh, maybe our affirmative isn't as durable as we thought, then you got to, you know, roll up your sleeves and make it happen. Or a lot of times for us on the negative, we realize no one's really exploited the size portion of the nuclear weapons topic. We really need to get our generics in order for that because that's where it's headed. So I don't know. I have a lot of little examples of sort of guessing where the topic would go like that, and some of them better guesses than others. But I think you kind of constantly need to be in that mode, where is this headed, and making sure you're prepared enough for those contingencies.
You talked about having debaters practice new arguments, kind of prepare to read new affirmatives or prepare to read new negative arguments. If a high school debater or high school team is listening to this, and let's say they have a new affirmative for one of their big upcoming tournaments, how would you advise them to practice that? Let's say it's just the two of them, or maybe they have another team at their high school. Kind of what are some of the things that they should do to practice a new affirmative or practice going for a new negative argument?
Yeah, I would say the single biggest mistake that people make when they prepare a new affirmative for their state tournament, for their, you know, for the NDCA, for whatever their big season-ending thing is, even in college, is they kind of have a high school camp approach to what the affirmative is. It's really annoying to write a new affirmative. There's a couple cards that are always difficult to research. You get it together, the 1AC is in order, you've thought about a few 2AC blocks, and you think you're done. But that sort of ignores why your old affirmative was pretty good in the first place, and that's because a lot of people tested your old affirmative. A lot of negatives laid their eyes on it and made a lot of good arguments and bad arguments, and from that you were more prepared for more situations than you might expect. And so one thing that we like to do in East Lansing is sort of simulate that, and I think the foundation of the MSU debate team is to have one of the coaches, instead of having a full-on practice debate, just say, here are some of the off-case arguments that we're hypothetically running. Here are some arguments that we've made against the case. Show the students some evidence. Take a half hour, prep that together. Give the students on their new affirmative as long as they'd like to kind of research a new advantage or kind of get their answers ready for that speech, and to just keep doing that, or to have other students on the team cross-examine the first affirmative and ask about this underlying portion of the card, et cetera, to sort of simulate that level of familiarity. So I think one thing that surprises other programs is that, you know, the affirmative that we ran in the finals of the NDT, I mean, I don't think I could count the number of times Carly and Eric in some way practiced that affirmative between the tail end of January and the start of the national debate tournament. I mean, I do know that, like, the questions that were asked in them and the final round of the NDT had been asked of them multiple times, if that makes sense, and that there's a comfort which comes from that. And I kind of have a Chris Weber approach to coaching, in that I think that when students are in really, really big debates and they're really, really nervous, they kind of want to call a timeout. They kind of get nervous, even if they're really gifted. And I just sort of like having a familiarity that is analogous to your old affirmative when you run your new affirmative. A lot of people who run new affirmatives actually kind of don't do that well if you look at the history of it. And I think that that's the reason. I think they'd rather be in their comfort zone. And so you gotta build up with your peers on the team, your coaches on your staff, that kind of level of familiarity.
JP, you've done that with high school kids. You've coached two TFC champions. How do you, specifically working with high school kids, what is the approach that you took, you know, before those big tournaments to get them ready?
Well, a sidebar in relation to Will's comment, I was watching the finals of the NDT, and I think around the 1AR, 2NR, I kind of walked over to Will. And at that point, I thought pretty clearly that the affirmative was going to win. But the thing that impressed me most, it was a great 1AR, no question, but the 2AC I thought was outstanding. And I could tell, even on the case, there was language that she had clearly said in practice speeches before, and dismissing an argument or framing an impact, things like that. And it was obvious that they had basically given this 2AC many times prior. And, you know, it's hard to lose debates like that if you're well-researched and well-practiced against teams that are just throwing together stuff that they might have thought about for a little bit. When I was coaching at Greenhill, one year I thought we did a really good job with this. We had four new affirmatives on the Africa topic, maybe five. And every one, primarily because I think in high school debates are usually lost in the 2AC with new affirmatives, I got back into the ring and did one NCs that they then, well, that the 2A, Olivia, responded to. And I just made these absurdly big, eight off, you know, a bunch of case arguments, every process argument possible, because that's usually what they hear, that they haven't really heard, you know, reading a case that people have negatives to. And I thought they had a much higher comfort level, you know, after having CX from me, 1NC from me, 2NC from me. You know, they felt then when they were debating just high school people that they were probably okay. Now, you know, obviously you can't control every contingency. They're tired, they're nervous, but just that practice goes so far.
Will, what is your philosophy about kind of when to break new arguments, when to essentially, you know, release them? When do you read a new position or new cards? Is there are there, you know, really good pieces of evidence or really good positions that you kind of develop research early in the topic that you save, thinking that these are kind of winning arguments at the season-ending tournament? Or do you, you know, if you find excellent new evidence about a dissent or something, do you sort of immediately incorporate that into the kind of working file that your debaters read?
I think, again, it depends a little bit. A little bit on the individual topics and a little bit on sort of how your season is going. So this year we sort of figured out we probably weren't going to win the Copeland at a certain stage in the season.
That was our next question.
You know, and
bring that in.
You know, maybe if we were in contention to, we might have broken one of the affirmatives that was ready or close to being ready at, you know, one of the later tournaments in the year. I can just remember certain topics where some of the people that I work with, we got to talking, and it was just like there's so few good core negative arguments that haven't been broken yet that we kind of need to save this, whereas on other topics there's a larger negative arsenal. So you got to play that by ear. But we definitely save arguments for big situations. I just don't think that the NDT is the only big situation, if that makes sense.
I think sometimes you have to, if you're coaching a team that you think could win the national championship, and let's say they've had a poor regular season, especially at high school, I think there's a big kind of momentum thing. I don't know how many teams do you guys realistically think that haven't won an Octos bid tournament could win the TOC? Probably not that many. I mean, there may be a few at the NDT that where that's happened. It seems like teams that didn't win majors that have turned around and won the NDT. But I think sometimes, even if you're not in the Copeland race or the Baker race, where you might say we really need to just get a big win. And
well, that was our next question, which was, do you think, and you know, both of you have been in these situations before, do you think that, you know, pursuing the Copeland trades off with your ability to win the NDT, in the sense that you said that you at some point this year knew, you know, maybe after the coast or something, that, you know, Carly and Eric weren't going to win the ND, weren't going to win the Copeland. You know, does that change how you approach Texas and the other tournaments before that and between the NDT? And do you think that if you were still in the Copeland race after the coast, or, you know, the Texas would have been different in what you would have done, or earlier tournaments might be different?
And in the same way as that would apply to high school, you know, if you try and win every tournament you go to, kind of go all in with, you know, mm-hmm. your best arguments, kind of commit 100% to winning each tournament, does that trade off with winning the season-ending kind of big tournament?
Well, I guess I'm tempted at some level to say that there is a trade-off between sort of the Copeland or the Baker and winning sort of a season-ending national championship. And I'm tempted to say that because Michigan State has never won the Copeland, but, you know, we've done well at the National Debate Tournament. On the other hand, the truth of the matter is, in terms of advising high school students or prospective college debaters, I think that the blueprint for succeeding kind of in either realm is the same. And so I kind of think that you could take that idea too far. I mean, if you want to win the Copeland, I think you need to roll up your sleeves and work hard every day to make that happen and be prepared for a lot of different contingencies. And if you want to win the NDT, you know, it's pretty much the same thing. And so I think that those are good habits to formulate during the course of the season. And it may be that you go to an important high school or college tournament very prepared and you don't utilize everything in the arsenal. You leave a few things in the box, and that might help you later on for the season-ending national championship. But I'm kind of reluctant to give advice to people that's like, if you find a good argument, save it for when it's really going to matter. I think you can take that too far. I can think of a lot of situations where we've determined that something is sort of precious, and we've broken it in an important but maybe not crucial moment, because it's also important to feel like you're debating well. It's important to have momentum. It's important to kind of be viewed by the community writ large as a team that is in contention. So I think you can take that a little too far. I mean, I have particular thoughts about the Copeland, but, you know, I'll kind of leave that answer there for now.
Before you get to JP's answer, just like, let's say this year, if you had been in the finals of Texas, mm-hmm. And debating either Emory or Northwestern, who was, you know, the other two top teams there, do you think, and you guys had a bunch of new affirmatives at the NDT, would that have been a situation where you would have considered reading a new affirmative, or do you think that in that spot, you know, obviously there are a lot of calculations like panel, mm-hmm. et cetera, you know, side constraints, but, you know, theoretically, is that a spot where it would have been likely that you all would have read a new affirmative, or would you have, you think, you know, save that new affirmative, said winning round five at the NDT and getting a bye?
Yeah. My answer to this is a little bit complicated. We talked about that contingency prior to going to the Texas tournament, and we were a little bit concerned that the team had not done well enough at the tippy-tippy top since winning Kentucky, that people were starting to be concerned that maybe we weren't as viable of a contender. And so we would have, I think, gunned all out to win that debate, not for the sake of faring better in the Copeland race, but for the sake of sort of the community psychology which is associated with that. Mm-hmm. We'd also lost quite a few debates to Emory and Northwestern kind of in the interim. They're very good teams, and we had struggled with them a little bit, and I think it might have been just nice, the coaches thought, to just kind of get a win under our belt in that situation. And there's enough time between the end of the last regular season tournament. If you have three or four new affirmatives done and you don't use one of them, you can kind of make up for that, if that makes sense. But maybe like our very best new affirmative that you know, we utilized in the finals of the National Debate Tournament, we might have not deemed the situation to be precious enough to break that one, because we, in particular, we felt like that matched up well against some of our opponents. So, yeah.
JP, Copeland race and NDT, is there a trade-off?
Well, I think that, you know, one thing that wasn't really mentioned, what Will said, that I largely agree with, a lot of teams win the NDT that are in the thick of a Copeland race. Mm-hmm. I don't know about Burke and Harrigan, how kind of far along into the Copeland race they were. Where
they got votes for first place.
Yeah, so,
right, so
they were in the
third.
Thick of it. Stahl and Strauss were in the thick of it until the bitter end, too. I was second in the Copeland race, and it was, you know, we got a couple mm-hmm. first place votes. And so, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of times where people are leaving it all on the line and they still end up winning the MBT. Usually that's because they're the best teams in the country and those things tend to sort itself out. I think if you're in contention for the Copeland, you've got to leave everything on the line and say, we're going to find some new stuff for the MDT. Same thing in high school with the Baker and the TOC. And then the example I was going to get from that I kind of mentioned earlier with the, you know, have you won a tournament yet? When I coached the Rogans, they had not won a tournament until Harvard. And we broke a new affirmative, won the round robin in Harvard. And so we had just amazing momentum going into the TOC. And they were confident and knew they could win anything. So, yeah, sometimes I think even if you don't have Copeland or Baker, you know, you've got to, and that kind of ties into what Will was saying about if they got to the finals of Texas, they would have dipped into their arsenal.
Let me add one other thing, which is I think one thing that's unique and important about the NDT, and I think at some level this is true at the TOC as well, is that you need to be able to win in front of what are commonly understood as the best judges, the best critics, to win the NDT. No one shortcuts their way to the NDT. It's tough, you know, judges. And so I think that you can maybe succeed in the short term during the course of a college season by trying to avoid those judges. And that might be a way in which you could shortcut your way to a better standing in the Copeland and be sort of cheating your long-term chances, if that makes sense. I think one thing that we really learned when we were close to winning some national debate tournaments but hadn't quite gotten there is that were we kind of creating the right curriculum with our strike card for our students to be prepared for the debates that were really going to matter. And if you look who winds up judging the final round of this national debate tournament, you've got, you know, Dr. Gordon Stables from Southern California, Dr., you know, Ryan Galloway from Samford, you have David Hyde. I mean, these people are people that are not afraid to vote against you. These are people that are really, really experienced, in many cases, policy-oriented judges. And so I have seen a few teams that I think have sort of missed that, you know, through the years. And I think our students would say, man, it was really annoying to constantly be judged by David Height, who, you know, could vote against them in a wide variety of spots, and then very thankful at the end of the day that they understood how he judged and that they had a feel for sort of his philosophy when they had their Nexus round, the round that they would care about more than any other. So you kind of got it. You do kind of have to play the game, I think, a certain way as you go in order to be prepared for the biggest debates, if that makes sense.
Now, obviously, it would be nice if we had had the ability to do this a little bit earlier, but, you know, teams can still use this for this year's TOC, and, you know, they can listen to this podcast again for next year's TOC, you know, earlier on in the year. But both of you have been to the TOC a bunch. What do you think high school teams can and should do better, and what can they learn from the way you all prepare for the NDT and other tournaments and how they should be preparing for their last year? I know, obviously, we talked about thinking about the tournament early on at the in the season, but just, like, what else have you seen at the TOC from your experience there that mistakes teams have made that they can even try to fix and not do at the TOC necessarily?
You know, I mean, Jonathan Paul is more of an expert. It's been a long time since I coached in high school, but I will just quickly say that when I judge there or when I watch debates there, it feels to me like the new affirmatives that are run at the TOC are prepared for convenient 1NCs as opposed to inconvenient 1NCs. There are annoying arguments that negatives are going to raise and are going to be all the more comfortable raising in the context of a new affirmative that your new affirmative has to be able to deal with. And if you're not willing to dig deep and do the research which defends the certainty of the plan, the timeliness of the plan, even if those arguments are suspect or theoretically invalid, you just don't have a thoroughly prepared 1AC unless you're ready for those contingencies. I mean, it's every affirmative's dream that the other team will stand up and make a few harm takeouts and run a bad dissat. And many new affirmatives are fully prepared at the TOC or the NDCA for that sort of contingency. But the truth of the matter is, that's probably what the debate's not going to hinge upon. So when we've prepared for, you know, the affirmatives that we've run at the National Debate Tournament, one reason that we like to do speeches along the way is that we realize there are sort of blind spots against certain arguments that we have. And when you find one good answer to a certain blueprint of counterplans, it winds up being useful in a lot of different other situations that you didn't fully anticipate. And so practicing early and not putting the annoying things at the bottom of the to-do list is probably the single biggest tip that I could provide. I don't know if you have different advice.
I'll speak to just the TOC. I made an assessment, I guess, probably my second year at Green Hill, that usually for our top teams, no team that in an ELIM or a big debate would read their old affirmative against us. Generally speaking, I was right in that guess. And so our preparation was almost exclusively on the negative new generic strategies that we could then use to be inconvenient when it seems. And, you know, we would think through, okay, they're going to read a new affirmative, and so on Africa, if they have any intelligence whatsoever, and presumably they do if they could beat us, they'll have an answer to international counterplans. So what counterplan strategies, you know, can we deploy that will solve whatever the U.S. key arguments were? And on that topic, it was a lot of relations stuff, and so we geared a lot of strategies towards that. And honestly, we went back and looked at, for a couple of our ideas, just went through old camp stuff that didn't get really used that much in the year. Like Michigan did a debt relief counterplan that year, and no one really read it during the year. And we used that one negative debate against the new case of the TOC, and it worked just kind of as we planned. And so things like that. And again, I mean, high school topics, generally speaking, are a lot broader than college topics. And so I think that's usually it. Whereas on this topic, I think I could have totally seen the good teams sticking with variants of no first use, de-alerting, TNWs. In high school, it's just all over the map. There's so much. And you get all of this kind of new research infusion. And then the other thing, and Will actually was the person who ended up saving us this year, he said, on this Africa topic, he said, people are going to read condition counterplans. Because that was the topic in college that year. And I kind of said, I don't know, Will, like, we kind of looked for some of this stuff at the start of the year, and there's this weird thing, if they do it to all the countries, said, no, they're going to. I'll do answers. And, you know, sure enough, we debated that three times, like three AF debates at least. And so, see what, and I don't know how that would work on this topic at all, but,
you know. Oh, no, there'll be college hand-me-downs on this topic.
Oh, yeah, definitely college hand-me-downs.
Yeah.
But, yeah, that's huge, I think,
I guess to wrap up this part of the podcast, Will and then Jonathan, if you could give one piece of advice to a debater who's preparing, you know, in the next 2 weeks to go to their biggest tournament of the year, so it's the TOC or it's their state tournament or it's their NFL qualifiers, what would you tell them, and kind of what's the one thing that you think would be most helpful for them as they prepare?
Well, avoid Windows Vista. I don't really like that operating system. I had a lot of trouble with it. I'm particularly proud that we did well in light of the fact that we had Windows Vista. What is it thinking about? What is the little circle going on there? I don't even know. You know, if the Windows people are mad at me, that they can contact me at repcowill@msu.edu, and, you know, we'll have at it. But going into their last tournament of the year, I think that it's a mistake to get too far out of your own comfort zone. I think that for all that we talked about the strategy of breaking new affirmatives and breaking new negatives, if you're going to write new stuff, you need to know it beyond just sort of having it in a file. I think you need to have practiced it a little bit. And I think those are big, nerve-wracking debates. It's okay to be nervous. Nervous means that you care. But it's not okay to be nervous and totally uncomfortable and totally unfamiliar with your stuff, and you don't want to call that time out. You kind of want to, you know, Jonathan Paul says that he's impressed with how Carly gave her 2 AC in the final round, but as valuable as it is to have blocks on, you know, some of the things that Northwestern said in that debate, it's also just nice from a literally a performance, what you're conveying to the kind of panel, to just come off as though you're in your comfort zone. And I think that that is something that could be especially important at a high school state tournament, could be especially important at any stage of the game. Coming off like you're winning is underrated. It's pretty important, you know.
What do you think, Jonathan?
I don't know. I mean, there's so much, but I would say make sure you have your stuff together a week before and start filing, practicing. I mean, I just, the number of times where you see, and you'll get, you know, assuming you're fully staffed with coaches, there's going to be a lot of new stuff that you'll have to deal with and developments that happen at the tournament. And so all of the material that you have needs to be filed, understood, practiced well in advance of the tournament.
I think that comfort zone thing that Will says is really, really important, because my first year coaching a team at the TOC, we did that. We had a team that was maybe could clear, but probably not. And they'd read the same AF basically the whole year, and we're pretty good on the AF. And we decided that we were going to go in with a bunch of new AFs. And they were just not a team that was built well enough to deal with, you know, the blind side, the slew of random stuff. And they weren't good enough on just the randomness that they could hear. And the mistake we made was reading those new AFs, because I think that we probably would have won two out of those three debates that we lost. We lost three at rounds, breaking three new AFs, just on the random crap that you could hear. And I think that we probably would have won two of those if we had just stuck with our AF and been like, this team is not a team that needs to read a new AF. That taking them out of that comfort zone will put us in a bad spot. And I think that, you know, we were able to do that differently, you know, last year at the TOC, where we just stuck with the same AF and read new advantage versions of it, and we're able to win, you know, more AF debates and get to the Elims. So know where you're at and know, you know, have a realistic assessment. It's nice to say that I have five new AFs that I can read if I have five AF debates, but if you're not ready, or if you're not built, or if you get really nervous in those situations, keeping the same AF that you know and have read all year long will prevent you from losing it in that big situation. And, you know, I definitely think that was a mistake that we made when we approached the TOC that year. And it definitely, you know, you don't want to have that regret. You want to think about that earlier on rather than kind of after the fact. Whoops.
As you're preparing for your last tournament, some of you are seniors, or if you're juniors looking forward, your last tournament in high school doesn't have to be your last tournament. You can go on to debating college, and a lot of people, a lot of high school students probably or definitely have the opinion that if they're not a nationally successful high school debater, if they're not the kind of debater who is, you know, at the Tournament of Champions or in contention to clear at the Tournament of Champions, that they just don't have what it takes to become a good college debater, that they're kind of too far behind, they're never going to catch up with their peers that are seem so much better than them in high school. But at MSU in particular, it seems like that has been, you know, decisively disproven. There have been several debaters at Michigan State during Will's tenure that came from high school debate backgrounds that were regional or local, high school debaters that weren't the kind of national circuit superstars that some other colleges recruit. And so, Will, I want to get your thoughts on sort of what attributes do you look for in a recruit. I mean, obviously it would be nice to have the superstar who's been traveling for a few years and has been clearing at the TOC, but what do you look for in the debaters that don't have that pedigree, and kind of what do you look for to identify those high school students who you think you can kind of dream on and see as prospects that could be excellent college debaters?
Well, let me start by saying I don't think that high school juniors, high school seniors should feel like they need to be recruited in a, you know, major college basketball, major college football kind of way. I mean, that, you know, I think by and large, almost every high school debate coach, every college debate coach is looking for people that are interested, that want to do it. You know, we never have too many people that want to work hard, that want to be part of the system. And then I think, I guess my second answer to your question kind of more specifically is, I think a good coach has to work with a wide variety of kids and kind of figure out the right style for them. I mean, working with Eric Lanning is very different than working with Casey Harrigan, different than working with Greta Stahl. I mean, all those people are just very different people. And I think the challenge in sort of my time as a coach is figuring out, well, what way does Eric Lanning kind of learn the best? In what way does Carly Wunderlich, so what does she need from the coaching staff? So you got to be a little diverse. But it all starts with students that want to work hard. I mean, I kind of think the way that you can debunk this idea that everyone needs to have been a national circuit star is to find kids that are invested. And I found that some of our students are invested in different parts of the activity, if that makes sense. Some students really love to give speeches but don't like to cut a bazillion cards. Some students like to cut a bazillion cards but don't like to give speeches. I mean, that is the yin and yang. That is the difference between Carly and Eric. And we sort of had to make Eric cut more cards and make Carly, you know, give a few more practice speeches. But both of them had a willing, I think both of them didn't like to lose. And they both had a willingness to work hard, and good things flow from that, you know. If you have a lot of time to work with invested students, good things happen, you know.
Jonathan, as a new director at a college program that historically has been extremely successful, but that in recent years has sort of been rebuilding, coming back to national prominence, what are you sort of looking for in potential debaters at Georgetown? What do you see as the attributes that you kind of want in someone who's going to come to be a Hoya and debate for your program?
Someone that works hard and someone who believes they can win tournaments is kind of the number one thing. And obviously, like Will said, anyone who wants to be a part of the program, we're happy to have them. And, you know, it's funny, I get all of these letters and emails from people that have no policy debate background, but they want to be on the team. And I usually politely point them in the direction of something else. And there was this one guy, Lat, this summer, who emailed me, I think, 5 times before I finally responded. And he was like, no, really, I want to do policy debate. And he debated 2 years in Minnesota, but his parents wouldn't let him debate 2 years. And so he comes, and, you know, we do our assignment list, and we give him something absurdly, you know, I'm like, obviously this person is not going to pan out. And he's like, a week later, 300 pages, clearly the best work of anyone on the team. And, you know, this guy's named Anton, and he's had 2 years of high school experience, but he's going to clear at national tournaments when he's a senior. It's going to probably take that long, but, you know, and so if someone, you know, has that kind of interest, you know, I think that anyone who's smart enough to get into Georgetown and, you know, wants to succeed in debate like that certainly is what we're looking for. But, you know, I think in the current state of our program, you know, we want people that think they can come in and, you know, get to that point on their own.
Something both of you all said, which, you know, maybe you can talk about a little bit more, and I know Will's talked about it a little bit, was that when we had our what would you do differently thing in our podcast last time we did our podcast, I said that my focus my freshman year and sophomore year was like, I need to cut 1 million cards in order to get better at debate. And both of you all said that work hard. Now, you know, for this debater, you know, for these debaters that aren't coming in with a lot of Elam success and not a lot of like coaching experience, you know, can you define work a little bit more in the sense of what are the attributes and what are the things that they should be doing in the debate office or in debate in general that's not just cutting cards? Like you said, Carly needed to do more practice speeches and stuff like that. Like, what are those types of things that they can be doing to get better? Because I found that I focused so much on card cutting that I didn't do enough practice speeches earlier on, and I didn't do other things that could have maybe helped me get better at an earlier age, and that, you know, I got those debate experience by having the debates, but it meant that you lost more in the, you know, interim. What are the things that you can do in a debate office or should be doing in a debate office that, you know, the kids who want to catch up can do to get there?
You have to work on your weakness. I mean, it's not more complicated than that, and that's how you have to coach different students differently, because different students come in with different weaknesses. I've worked with students that were not great speakers, not very accomplished when they were in high school, but, you know, like this example with Anton, man, they could cut fantastic pieces of evidence. Well, Anton needs to reach a point where he's not cutting 300-page files anymore, and Anton needs to invest some more of that time in getting better in the in-round speeches, if that makes sense. You know, Carly came into Michigan State University, and she was obviously a really intelligent person. We'd worked with her in the summer camp. We kind of knew that she was a diamond in the rough, but she just didn't have the rounds under her belt that, you know, a lot of the top-level national high school circuit kids had. So she each had to give a lot of speeches, you know, and from that she got better, and, you know, that's how it works. Eric Lanning, when he showed up at Michigan State University, I mean, the guy sounds great. I mean, the guy doesn't need to, you know, work on talking, you know what I mean? You know, but he's got to get better with research. He had to get better and more knowledgeable about his own positions. And he had to work on, you know, improving his coverage and whatnot. And you need to identify, I think, as a coach, the weaknesses in your students and force them to confront that. And, you know, one thing that, in a crazy way, I'm a little bit proud of is that the focus of the program stays long-term, you know, so if we don't win the freshman breakout at the Kentucky tournament, which we never win that thing, okay, it's okay, you know what I mean? Because we have our eyes on sort of a different game, if that makes sense. And, you know, I mean, I don't even remember who Carly and Gus lost to in the elimination rounds of the freshman breakout at the Kentucky tournament, but hopefully they were there working on their weaknesses, if that makes sense.
And that, I think it was DeLuca and Burke might have won it.
They might have won it. All right, exactly. You know, but hopefully they were working on their weaknesses. Who knows? You
know. JP, you know what? When I say
work hard, what do you mean? I think having command of your arguments is ultimately what it comes down to. Whether, you know, some debaters are going to cut thousands of cards over the year because they're good at it and they want to put that amount of time on it. Some debaters are not very efficient or talented researchers, but they can still gain a command of the arguments that they have at most places, assuming there are other people doing work. Obviously, if you're at a high school where it's just you and your partner and you can't do research, you're probably not going to do that well. But I think that is, to me, you know, what you see just, you know, both high school and college, someone who knows what the arguments that they're making and isn't just executing blocks, but knows what's going on.
I think something that falls in line with that is that presumably these, you know, individuals will not jump in, especially since these programs are large, to the top team, you know, immediately. What should they be doing as younger people on the team, and how should they be listening or taking information that you might have with, like, how does a freshman at MSU today take a team conversation that you have with Carly and Eric about something, and what should they be doing in, you know, those meetings, or how do they translate that information that might seem like it's over their head at the time into something that they can use in the future? Because, you know, at Northwestern especially, you know, there's usually, you know, a top team that gets a lot of the focus, but there are a lot of people there in the room when these meetings happen. How do you take that information and don't kind of, you know, have your IM open, but how do you use what is said to others in a productive way so that, you know, while you might not be getting coached for the NDT, but if you're in the room, glean that information in. Is there an emphasis on that, like, making sure kids listen to what goes on?
One thing I'm excited about is that I feel like we have a very strong incoming class at Michigan State, but that none of those students need to necessarily be on the top team, which will be comprised of Eric and Gus, and that's a team that will be in the mix. And so I want those students to sit in those meetings. I don't want, even if they'll never run that new affirmative, I don't want that to be kept secret from them, if that makes sense. The security risk is not that large, you know. And I think that, you know, it'll be a whole new world for some of those incoming students, but it'll be very valuable for them to kind of see what is happening and for them to kind of ask questions and be like, why are we, you know, running this advantage with this, you know, weird impact scenario? Why are we doing X, Y, and Z? And, you know, I think a common mistake that coaches make is that they think that they are the primary or only vehicle for teaching the students. In reality, the students learn a lot from older members on the team. They learn a lot from a certain core set of judges that they have, if that makes sense. And so the single most valuable thing that you can do as a first-year college debater is to just be attentive and soak it all up, if that makes sense. You know, sit in on some of the pre-round coaching before the semifinals, which isn't too annoying. After you get eliminated, or even if you didn't clear, go and watch Stephen Wheel debate. I mean, that guy is maybe even historically good. You know, go and watch Fisher and Spiesman. That's a great team. And, you know, maybe if you're lucky, if you're a freshman, you'll debate a team like that once and get beat really badly, if that makes sense. But you could watch them debate multiple times and glean some things. Or ask your coaches, what are some of the bad habits that they have that I could do differently? I mean, there's just so many resources at your disposal other than just sitting down and cutting cards, if that makes sense. And honestly, your first year, you should cut some cards, but you should learn how to go to school. You should make some friends outside the debate team, etc. And one of the most valuable things that you can do is just sort of absorb all the educational tools that you have. And I think you should also avoid Windows Vista. I want to get back to that. That's an important thing. If one of the older kids or Stephen Wheel is like, I'm a Vista guy, you know, those people don't have a monopoly on the truth, all right? I have a real problem with that. So I guess I wanted to get that out.
How much would you say when your team, MSU, is preparing for the NDT?
Yeah, go ahead, ask some questions.
Does that take place amongst the entire team or the coaches and Carly and Eric?
We definitely have some meetings that are with the coaches and Carly and Eric, or like a coach with Carly and Eric. You know, I remember when I was sort of when you were at Northwestern and I was coaching, and one of your peers, Raja Gadapati, came up to me and he's like, how do you decide who coaches which round? And I said, it kind of depends who did the assignment. And he was like, whoa. You know what I mean? And so sometimes we have one-on-two moments, you know what I mean? But sometimes we have sort of macro, not before the round.
Well, that's no coaches were cutting cards at Northwestern.
Right. So. But my point is that you do kind of have to make a conscious effort as a coach to kind of, you know, bring those people in. Like, I thought it was very helpful for Burke and Harrigan to be on the team when Stahl and Strauss were there. And we identified them and a couple other students as people that could kind of be the next generation. And you want them to sit in on those things. You kind of, you know, can do that. But then there are other times, honestly, where we kind of need to boot everyone out of the round and room and just have those moments. But I think there's more emphasis on it in Michigan State than people know. And I really do want this next generation of kids to, I think it's a great time for them to be arriving at Michigan State and to learn from some of our older students right now. Yeah. I don't know if that's
I feel like it was a little different at the Hardy House, right? Were those meetings more top, like how did those meetings kind of go?
Well, we have one team meeting a week. And then usually the doc would take Foster and I out to lunch every day. And talk about the and with the other coaches and and so there was a lot of, you know, coaches with just this one team.
Let me give the most concrete example that we have. Again, the foundation of the MSU debate team is simulating 2ACs or simulating negative block speeches. And it's commonplace on our team to have the younger students. We set up a speech for everyone to give. Okay? And the coaches will listen to it on various people's time schedule. But it's commonplace to invite the students to listen to Carly's speech, invite the students to listen to Eric's speech. And they have given the same speech.
Right.
All right. And it's not cheating for them to listen to that speech and then maybe when it's their turn, borrow some of those ideas. And I think that they think it is cheating. But in fact, it's a pretty good way to improve. It's no different than watching Stephen Wheel in the semifinals of the Kentucky tournament, you know. So, you know, I mean, that is sort of... I think it's very important to have your younger students listen to your older students debate or older students in the community debate. You know, I think it's very important.
Well, yeah, I mean, I remember when I was in this kind of, I didn't have much high school experience. Will judged me when I was in high school.
Did.
Voted against me several times.
Katie Taylor High School, right?
I'm the one judge that never voted for anyone. But always voted against everyone. I'm giving the double loss, apparently.
2-5 and 3-4 at the TOC. And, you know, the Duck obviously thought I had some talent. And I was debating during Gottlieb and Sparacino's senior year. That was my freshman year. And I don't know that I had any clue what arguments they were going to read at the MDT.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I was not in the loop. But that whole year, I stayed till Tuesday morning. In every tournament, and I watch, you know, Bailey Golly versus Gottlieb Sparacino, Eber McKeon versus Donald and Monick, you know, just all of these. And for me, I was just in awe, and that's how I learned how to debate. It wasn't, you know, don't get me wrong, doing rebuttal redos in the Hardy House and, you know, listening to strategy meetings help, but really watching is what I think for debaters that are still not there yet.
Well, one thing we do that is a touch different than that is that we, Greta and I do this thing that we call play lab, all right, which is if one of our teams is in an elimination round or if our teams have been eliminated but we're judging, let's say, a semifinal or a final, we invite the younger students on the team to watch and flow the debate with us, and during prep time breaks we talk about where the debate is headed, what we are thinking. We actually started to invite kids from other schools to do that as well. And, you know, that's not any different than what one of us would do at a summer lab, hence the title, but no one's thinking to do that in college debate. But it's not only valuable to just watch Bailey and Golly debate, it's also valuable to kind of talk with someone who's judging the round or talk with someone who has judged rounds like that and kind of get a feel, you know, for that.
I think that that's... That information there is important on two levels. The first is that if you are a younger person and you're at that tournament and you went 3-5 and you didn't clear, or 3-4 and you didn't clear, the Elim day is not wake up at noon, go get lunch, pack your suitcase, come down and get ready for the airport at 4 o'clock. It's be there at 8 a.m. when that coin flip happens, watch the debate from the start to finish, flow that debate, and watch all of those Elims. But the second thing is that if you're an older member on a team, like understand that what you do, you know, if you don't have that much coaching or that much instruction or this type of information, you know, the kids that you have learn from you. Like, in our debate room, when I sit and talk to, you know, Matthew and Max about something, Jason and Raheem are always there listening. And I know that, you know, I can see when I look at them that they're listening to what we're talking about. And this might never be a strategy that they'll ever read. But the conversation that we're having about this and that is something that they know that they will have with me in a year. And that they know that it's something that they need to do. So if you're not there, or if you're like, oh, the coach isn't giving me that much attention because we're not on the top team, there's a lot that you can get. And if you're on that top team, know that, you know, what the talking out your thought process or, you know, even telling the younger kids, this is why I'm doing this, is a lot to them and how it'll, you know, how it works out. Josh Lynn, who was a senior Emory debater when I was a freshman, you know, we somehow managed to have a class together, and we sat there during this class, and, you know, we would talk about debate, and then we'd go to lunch after that class, and we'd, you know, I'd always pick his brain, and he'd give me information on stuff like that, and well, a lot of it was like he wanted me to check out 100 books for him at the library, and he was never going to return. You know, there was information that was useful there, so, you know, it's a two-way street where when you're younger, you get that information from older kids, but when you're older, you know, understand that there are, you know, everyone that's younger than you in that room is listening to you and looking at what you're doing and something that they're going to emulate.
Well, and it isn't just a tip for college debaters that are in big college programs. It's a tip for two other kinds of students. If you're at a high school program, there's a lot of rounds that you can watch, either older students in your own school or the students that are involved in the elimination rounds of the events that you attend. And there's a lot to glean there. There's lots of relationships to develop. You can learn. You know, I mean, I tell our kids sometimes to just go and listen to David Heitz's Oral Critique because that's coming up at some point. You know what I mean? And then, you know, if you're not on a college debate program where there are these older students on the college team that are, you know, apt to be in the semifinals of the NDT or whatnot, there's a lot to be learned by just sort of, you know, watching big debates. And I think you'll find in high school and college that most judges and most coaches, you know, are willing to kind of share thoughts with you about how that debate broke down, listen to your input on, you know, why you thought the debate could have been decided differently or why the decisions that were made were poor decisions or good decisions. And there's just, I mean, there's so many opportunities for learning that are not the obvious blueprint of sit in room with teacher lecture about, you know, debate research. There's a lot of other opportunities.
I think that it's funny, the debaters that came to mind immediately when you described that are debaters that JP coached and that I saw sit in about a million rounds when they were sophomores and juniors, flowing with crazy sideways flowing on the floor on a tub lid, Anna Livin and Nupi Bhushan, and they were in your lab, and I can think of a few rounds where they sat next to you mm-hmm. and would flow and talk about it after the round, and I think that's something that not enough debaters do when you, you know, in the quarters, semis, finals of a lot of these big high school tournaments, it's just the judges and maybe a few kids, but it's not. There are a lot of kids at the tournament who are sitting in the hallways or whatever, not taking an opportunity to.
Yeah, and as invested as Anna and Nupi were, they were nowhere near as brazen as Priya, who one time, Priya Krishna, and she, there were six judges in the semifinals of the NDT that were sitting on the panel, and five of them I knew, and someone asked, who's that other one? I was like, oh, that's Priya. She's a sophomore in high school. All right, so, I mean, you know, the Green Hill students were not at all afraid to assert themselves and get themselves in very central components of it. There was a couple times when I was being tapped on the shoulder in the middle of, like, quarters of the NDT. So, but they were totally... That, I mean, more than anything, that is the attitude that, I do look for if I were to recruit a student. It's just wanting to be invested in that kind of way. Once you have someone that, you know, loves the game, in any aspect of the game, you can work with that. You know what I mean? And, you know, they got a lot better, I think, because they were so, they were just wanted to learn. You know.
I guess with that, we'll wrap it up. This has gone pretty long, but I think it's probably something that hopefully you all found interesting. I'd like to thank Jonathan Paul from Georgetown and Will Rutko from Michigan State for their time and for their willingness to share their thoughts. I guess we'll give a plug, both of them coach at college programs, obviously. If you're interested, I'm sure they would be happy to hear from you if you're entering college and you're thinking about debating. They both also run summer institutes, the Spartan Debate Institute at Michigan State and the Georgetown Debate Seminar at Georgetown. So if you want to spend your summer around coaches like this with this amount of success and these insights, you know, give those two programs a look. So Will and JP, thanks very much. For Roy Lefkowitz, I'm Bill Batterman, and thanks for listening to the latest 3NR podcast.